Shoot the Defence, the best podcast in the world. We're out here.
I keep saying Henry's a forward.
Richie, who's the best striker you've played against?
Henry.
And the fact that we had now taken our country and put our country on the map of world soccer, being the first African nation, the third world nation in the whole world to win an Olympic gold medal in soccer, you know, it was unbelievable.
If you're going to take the time to go and get a pig head and break my locker open and wrap my clothes in it, that's sending a different message to me.
I've had to protect my family from going out into the street because you'll have random people that just coming up and abusing them racially. Even some old school managers who are British, they still have the same racial undertones like the man in the street who they're trying to condemn.
Hello and welcome to a world exclusive edition of Shoot the Defence. Today I have with me a friend of the show and I'm delighted that Shoot the Defence are first to talk to our guest about his latest book. I was granted a review copy of the book and read it in just two sittings. The book is entitled Beckham, The Making of a Megastar and it is author Wayne Barton's 14th book with a Manchester United theme. He's been rightly described as the preeminent writer on the club. And this, although not exclusively about Manchester United, is again a brilliant book. It charts the career of David Beckham, a footballer whose media profile was so high, he rubbed shoulders with Hollywood stars and royalty and was used as a political asset when England were bidding for the Olympics and World Cups. He played for some of the biggest clubs in the world and won the biggest prizes too. Drawing on exclusive interviews with Beckham's former teammates, the book explores Beckham's contribution as one of the greatest players of his generation. Welcome to the show, Wayne. How are you?
I'm not bad, Mike. How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. I'm good. Wayne, let's first start with what I just said, that the book explores Beckham's contribution as one of the greatest players of his generation. Now, the reason why I want to start here is that very recently on Twitter, you felt the need to retort to some opinions that, among other things, Beckham was a one-trick pony. I mean, to me, that's an absurd assertion. And the book dispels such notions that Beckham was just an average footballer whose profile was elevated by his media prowess rather than his footballing talent, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And it is funny because every now and again you'll say something like that, remember when Beckham was dismissed as a one-trick pony? And then everyone will be like, that never happened. And then you just have to have a little look into my Twitter mentions to see, like you did, that it does happen still very much so. And it was quite prominent back in the day as well, Mike. I'm sure you can remember that. The criticism was always there. Funnily enough, it came after he'd sort of established himself into the first team and proven himself, and then sort of from 1999 onwards. I remember it being a big thing around the Ballon d'Or awards when he was... was it bronze or silver in that? And so the talk was very much then that he was overrated. And I think that was one of the things that compelled me to write the book. You know, this player who... For a period of time, I guess his profile was so big that you can't shy away from the idea that he could have been overrated because he was such a high profile name, the most high profile name in the country, maybe even the world for a time. It could still be in terms of football, but yeah, that was the thing that really compelled me to tell the story because I've always been a big fan of Beckham the footballer. I always felt that was one thing that was underappreciated about him, that his true talents and the things that got him to where he was went under the radar, which is curious considering that not much does about David Beckham.
No. I mean, indeed. I mean, towards the end of the book, you write, and I quote, "A career that saw 719 club appearances, 115 international appearances, 10 league championships and countless more accolades. One of the most famous football careers of all time," end quote. Was he taken for granted as a player?
Yeah, he was. You could even argue that he was taken for granted by Sir Alex for a little time. That he was deemed dispensable and his contribution in its absence was seen as indispensable. You know, he craved that central midfield spot, and as soon as he left 2003 to 2006... 2007, we were really missing a presence in the middle of the park. Yes, we had Keane, we had Scholes, but both of those players were suffering with different injuries and suspensions and things like that. They both had long spells out at the side, so there was a space in there for a player just like Beckham. We argued the point about it. I'm sure you and I would talk about Juan Sebastian Verón at length, and you know, our love for him as a player, and how when he left United, it seemed like that opening in the central midfield area where he could have sort of really flourished became available. Well, the same is true of David Beckham, because he had a similar sort of skill set to Veron. Maybe not as two-footed as Veron, and maybe not as bombastic, but certainly a skill set that was conducive to helping him play in that central midfield role, as he did for other clubs in his future as well. So, yeah, he's certainly underappreciated, and I think, like I said, the things that he had, the reliability of his set pieces and his delivery, those kind of things, they only really became truly appreciated when he left. But that's a sort of, I guess you would say, a backhanded compliment to his consistency, really, because it went that, like I'm saying, the few things that went under the radar about David Beckham were the things which really gave him the biggest value.
Absolutely, absolutely. Back to Twitter, and there was a conversation on the platform, again, very recently, where you screenshot a sentence from the book and offered people the opportunity to name what Beckham goal the sentence describes. Now, I mention it now so I can remind myself later. I mean, we will revisit this, and maybe you can reveal what the goal was at the end of the interview. But throughout the book, there are anecdotal quotes from former teammates and newspaper articles attesting to his brilliance. And early on in the book, in the chapter Star is Born, you quote Gary Pallister with the following quote. We understand that astonishing execution we had witnessed, end quote. And is a sentence and an observation by Pallister that pretty much followed Beckham throughout his career. And I guess two words sum up this, I would guess, peerless football talent: astonishing execution. How did Beckham hone this skill?
It was something really could credit his dad for, because it was born from those training sessions that he had, you know, with his dad as a semi-pro footballer, and they would, I mean, and it's funny, isn't it, because when you're a kid, when you're coaching kids, and you know, because you're a coach of kids, you want to see them do these individual things, express their talent. But Ted Beckham expressed and impressed the importance of consistent delivery, and he had David running down the pitch and crossing the ball so he could catch it, and you know, we all know the stories about how he would do that with the tyres hanging on the goals and everything like that. So the things that perhaps free kicks are fashionable and great to score, but the things like the delivery and everything like that, being the provider rather than the goal scorer, that was the unfashionable side of football. But Ted did so well in impressing that onto David to be that kind of player. I think that's where it came from, really, and very much one of the most prominent things that any recollection of Beckham in his early career is about how good he was on the ball and what his delivery was like. Yes, it needed some experience behind it to become as good as it did. But that's the kind of thing that only does come from experience and that kind of exposure to the first team. So certainly at his very young age, he was capable of doing that. And I think that, yeah, it came from his attitude as well, because, you know, you've got to impress that on a child, and a child's got to be willing to do that kind of thing. You know, they can easily resist against it. So it says a lot about the way that he was educated and a lot about him as a person, and perhaps even the way that he was raised, that he wasn't afraid to be that person who would do that hard work.
That's right, and you know that thing that you just said, hard work, is a thread running throughout the book. I love the fact that, and I didn't actually know this. I knew that he was he's a fan of Cantona, but I didn't know that Mark Hughes was someone he looked up to, and certainly Mark Hughes was one of my favourites growing up as well, and I love that. Bobby Charlton Football School, that played a part in Beckham's growth as a footballer and development as a footballer, didn't it?
It did. I don't think maybe as massive as... I mean, the thing is, the way that I described it in the book is that players are scouted, but David Beckham served himself up to United on a silver platter wearing a United strip, which is pretty much true, isn't it?
Yeah. You know,
he made sure that he was in the eye. And I think that's the thing. Not so much the mechanics of the soccer school that, you know, that helped him flourish, but more the platform that it gave him to do that, and the hard work that he'd done beforehand to put himself in the position where that would make the difference. And again, that's the thing. You said it's a theme running through David Beckham's career. And I would definitely agree with that. And obviously it's a thing that I've tried to express in the book, that everything that came to him was a product of that hard work. You mentioned idolising Mark Hughes. Mark Hughes was the idol of that period of time, wasn't he? Because it was Brian Robson, there was Gordon Strachan.
Yeah.
I mean, he modelled his haircuts on Gordon Strachan.
Yeah, that,
David Beckham.
That's hilarious.
It's just incredible to but not incredible in the aspect of, you know, that he was just a fanatical Manchester United supporter, and every player was his idol. Because of the platform that he got, which was earned to him at, you know, the age of like 12 or 13 by his incredible talent at that age, he was given these opportunities to be around the team more often than what a player of his age would. You know, so you would see him on the bench at West Ham sitting alongside Alex Ferguson, and people would be like, what that is that kid doing on the bench? But it was because he was based in London, and obviously it was a good opportunity to meet up with the club when they were down there, and things like that. And he took advantage of every one of those opportunities that came his way. Again, another theme that runs through his life and career, really. But you don't criticise someone for that, because that's the hard work that put them in that position.
Absolutely.
And yeah, very much on those early years. Yes, he was idolising those players, but he was also, he knew the hard work that it would take to become one of them. And yeah, Mark Hughes. It's funny, another thing that I thought about when writing the book was how much he tried to imitate those players. And he himself talked about it, you know, because they were his idols. He would try and take something from their games. Obviously, that's something that you learn from playing alongside them as well. But as a kid, you're obviously trying to do the things that those players, your idols, do. And, you know, Mark Hughes was no stranger to scoring spectacular goals. And, you know, Beckham was doing that from... He wanted to do that. He was trying to do something different from a very early age.
Excellent. Prior to the World Cup in 98, you know, people forget this, but he was subjected to incredible terrorist abuse. I mean, we know about it after the World Cup. I mean, there is acceptable football banter, and then there is sheer vitriol. Was Beckham the perfect storm for this? I mean, he was young, good-looking, talented, rich, newly engaged to a pop star, and he played for Manchester United. Perfect for cynics to have a pop at, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. And it, like you said, it was a perfect storm, really. So you had this period in 97 where, you know, he obviously he'd risen to some prominence by scoring from the halfway line against Wimbledon. You had this season where he was scoring loads of goals like that from long range. He was so good. And he was so confident as well. He was a bit of a poster boy, a good-looking lad from London. So he ticked a lot of boxes in terms of media favourite. And then you mentioned the Victoria thing. Yes, that happened. And then it was the end of that season, wasn't it?
I mean,
throughout that season, he was getting it a little bit. But we played West Ham in the final game of that season, and they were giving him stick. They were giving him a lot of stick because his relationship had just been sort of made public, basically. And so they were saying a lot of nasty things to him about his new girlfriend.
That's right.
But he scored. Well, United scored from one of his corners. Actually, that's a funny story, because is it Paul Scholes who scored? And this is another thing that I mentioned in the book. Paul Scholes scores in off the crossbar. I'm sure if Golden Technologies here today, they give that one Scholes. But Solskjaer, as he did, nodded in the rebound. But he came from Beckham's corner, and he responded by turning around and sort of acknowledging the West Ham fans that had been giving him a bit of grief. So, yeah, that had already started, and that was a year before the World Cup. But then Eric Cantona retired, and then you had this vacated role of the arch-nemesis, the sort of enfant terrible of English football, this prominent figure. I mean, as much as anyone wants to complain about Cantona's last year in United, he was still the most high-profile player. So once he left, there was a position there for Beckham to fill, which he did. He naturally just went into that position. Yes, for the shirt number, but also because of the profile and the fact that he was now an England international as well. So all those kind of things sort of, like you said, it was a perfect storm.
So is there then any evidence that this period prepared Beckham, if it is at all possible, for what was to come after the World Cup in 98? Do you think?
Yes and no, because he would have been getting somewhat used to that attention. I think he was a little taken aback by it. I think there was a couple of quotes, wasn't there, like, why are people interested in what I have for dinner? in a certain way, United should have been aware of that. And I think they were, to some extent. You know, Ferguson had protected Giggs from the press, famously, for these reasons. Mm-hmm. Beckham, as soon as he became associated with Victoria and the fact that, you know, a pop group needs a PR machine, he was attached to that, whether he liked it or not. And certainly Ferguson didn't like it, but he had to, tolerate it, basically, because, he had no choice with it unless they were going to break up. So it was new for Ferguson, new for United. It was an increase in attention, which was only comparable. You could say Gazza and Cantona after the World Cup 90, but I think it traces back to George Best, doesn't it? The fact that George Best comes on the scene, he's a massive... He's got fame comparable to a pop star. So United have seen that boost before in terms of a player who is that much more famous than even the most... I mean, George Best had Bobby Charlton and Dennis Law alongside him, and David Beckham had Roy Keane and Ryan Giggs and Paul Scholes alongside him. So it wasn't like he wasn't a famous footballer with famous footballers playing with him. He, you know, they were the most famous in the country. But his level of fame became something completely different. And because, like I said, of the Cantona factor as well, and the fact that there was this protagonist vacated, and he did walk into it, and he was a perfect person for it. And he also played up to it as well. It wasn't like he was... Yes, he worked hard, and yes, he was the ultimate professional as far as United were concerned. But he also played up to the abuse as well. If you know, and United loved him for it. If he did antagonise a rival, support, and then he did something good.
Great.
Absolutely. Can you remember there was a Chelsea game, January 98, where Frank Liberfer had been giving him a little bit of stick, mm-hmm. and some of the other Chelsea lads as well, and he scored a couple of goals in that game. One of them a great goal, and he went and celebrated behind the goal, mm-hmm. proper winding the Chelsea fans up. This is 7 months before the World Cup, do you know, so he was already building this sort of reputation as a player that the opposition fans love to hate. Yeah. So all that was coming into place. And
so he fueled some of it as well, you say?
Yeah, absolutely he did, because that was part of the mechanics of the elevation. Mm. Do you know, he knew that in order to build that profile, which he wanted to do, and he was keen to do it. This is a time when, you know, earnings outside the game were still as lucrative as within it. You know, and some could argue that's still the case, but certainly then, you know, 20 grand a week, you might want to think that you could earn similar amounts to endorsements outside of that. Mm-hmm. And that kind of profile came from not only endearing yourself to United fans, but making yourself known to opposition fans. And you're not going to make everyone love you when you play for Manchester United, unless you're Marcus Rashford going around saving kittens from trees. Yeah. So Beckham's way of getting into the public eye was to antagonise those fans and make them react to him. And, you know, that was good because it was good for our atmospheres. It was good for his form, because he seemed to thrive in that as well. It seemed to make him play better. You know, it helped him get that bit of edge to his game. And, you know, the other important thing to think about with Beckham is that he was running the line, so he was hearing that abuse
all
the time.
Yeah.
So he was fired up by that as well. I mean, you could say that a lot of those things prepared him to have a bit of a thick skin for the things that he would hear. Mm. Obviously, a lot of it went below the belt, and he expressed that on many times as well. He was never shy of expressing, you know, how close to the knuckle some of the stuff was and how far it went, but. And yeah, you shouldn't be prepared for some of the stuff, because some of the stuff should never happen.
Just out of order, wasn't it?
Yeah, but he did encourage it in a certain extent. So whether or not he was prepared for the kind of thing that happened after World Cup 98, I can't say that he was, because it's one of those things that you just don't know until it happens. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? It was crazy.
Yeah, and so much had been written about the red card he received for the petulant kick at Diego Simeone and Saint-Étienne at the World Cup. But reading the book, I'd forgotten what his manager and some players actually said about it, notably Ian Wright and Michael Owen. Now, I'm not denying them their opinions, but in retrospect, how Hoddle treated Beckham and what his teammates said to me at least points to greater, more salient reasons for the failure at the World Cup. It wasn't not being able to win on penalties, but to me, it just sounded like there was a lack of team unity. What do you say about that?
Yeah, it could be fair. I don't know if that's the reason for why they didn't do well, but it's one of those things where, because it can be so important in a team doing well, that if it's not there, when the cracks start to appear, it's easy to say that, you know, that could be a big reason for why. You know, England had a good team at that time. Yeah. They were doing well. It wasn't as if, I don't think it was Beckham's fault.
No.
But, you know, I say that with complete admission of bias there. I look at all the other factors, but I can easily understand why someone would say.
But the finger was pointed, wasn't it? The finger was pointed, unfortunately.
Even from his own, you know, from those within the dressing room, Hoddle hung him out to dry. Michael Owen never forgave him for it. It was just incredible. Yeah, I was surprised when I read Michael Owen's most recent autobiography where he was still blaming him for it. And I'm like, there's so many things that have happened in the past. I mean, like, especially Owen turning up to a major tournament, carrying a massive injury and still playing. I mean, do you not take a certain sense of responsibility for that? Do you know what I mean? Exactly, it's a weird thing, telling people to take responsibility and worst of all, blaming them. I mean, England drew the game.
Yeah.
They drew the game. They didn't lose the game. Mm-hmm. They didn't lose the game being exposed in midfield. They also had a goal disallowed, so you could blame, was it Shearer for the foul?
That's right.
There was all sorts of stuff. It's like the butterfly effect, isn't it? Yes, you can hold Beckham responsible for it, but there's holding someone responsible or knowing that someone did something wrong, and then going in on him the way that... I mean, the only reason Owen did that is because he knew that saying something about still blaming Beckham would get in the papers, because you just don't say anything like that. Teammates don't say it.
No.
You haven't heard anyone else from that World Cup squad, even Glenn Hoddle. Glenn Hoddle doesn't say in 2020, oh, David Beckham cost me the chance of winning the World Cup, because it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
It is, and you don't hear
the other players. It's a non-football thing to say, isn't it? You can't just attribute to the loss of a game to that one kick. It's just ridiculous.
Absolutely. And if he'd have played for... Not only if he'd have played for United, he wouldn't have said it, but if he'd have played for any other club than Liverpool, I don't think he would have said that. Honestly, I don't. I think he was trying to curry favour, which is fine. You know, that's his thing. And do you know what? It's like I'm saying, I can see why someone would blame Beckham, but don't blame him 20 years later. Don't hold him responsible for that. I mean, he scored a great goal. I think the thing is with Owen is that he's particularly bitter that great goal that he scored, some of the limelight went, because he scores this great goal and David Beckham's red card is what people... I might even argue that they remember Beckham's red card before they remember Owen's goal.
Yeah.
Do you know, which is says everything that you need to know about the profile of the players. At that time as well. I know, you know, obviously Owen rightly got a praise for the goal that he scored, but, you know, like I'm saying, so many things happened after that, not least England drawing the game and losing on penalties.
Yeah.
But yeah, I felt like you... I did remember that there was a lot of controversy at the time, but I was surprised when I went back and researched it just how much Hoddle... Who, by the way, had started the tournament not really doing Beckham any favours.
No.
Hung him out to dry at the end of it. It was ridiculous. And really, I think, was a massive contributing factor to... Because, I mean, it made it look like his own country had abandoned him. So that cultivated the sort of atmosphere that surrounded the start of the season.
Mm. And is that then exactly the reason why, when he returned back to Manchester, that the camaraderie... The culture, the them against us idea that, you know, Sir Alex Ferguson cultivated, helped Beckham overcome the incessant and over the top reaction when he did play away grounds, that he didn't see that togetherness with his national team, for which he was always immensely proud to represent. But when he came to United, it was that them against us, and that helped him get through it.
Yeah, and you might even argue that Beckham's red card in the World Cup helped United win the treble, because it focused him into playing some of his best football. And yeah, I do think you're right with that. And United had Ferguson was great for that anyway, you know, anything that could help cultivate that you against us or them against us mentality, it would buy into that 100%. And obviously this was one of the biggest occasions of that in history, so it did help with that. And yeah, a lot of the accounts of the players at the time are like, they basically closed ranks around him. You know, they made him feel that this is Beckham I'm talking about. They made Beckham feel like he was, you know, their number one. That they had, you know, they were looking out for him. Nothing was going to happen to him. They were all there supporting him. Nobody blamed him. None of the United lads who were at the World Cup blamed him. You know, they all wanted him to do well. And I suppose, you know, this is the extra advantage of developing a system, a youth system. Mm. Those players have been with him for 6, 7 years, 8 years, a lot of those players. So they knew him as a person. They were friends with him. They'd grown up with him. These are the intangible benefits. Do you know what I mean? People say, oh, what was the, you know, we don't have the patience for a youth system. You know, that's just one benefit of continuity. They don't even have to be good players. That's a benefit of continuity, that those players will be there for each other. So there'll be an extra 5% given on the pitch. That's with the most basic level of talent that's true of. So to take it to these talented players and for it to give an extra 5-10%, all of these things that, you know, I've talked to you about Jimmy Murphy's sort of long-lasting effect on the club and the sort of comeback mentality, all of these kind of things manifest themselves in the kind of attitude that we saw that year. Because to come back as many times as United did, to score as many late goals as they did, for that many players to play in the way that they did, especially David Beckham, probably Beckham more than any other, it's not an accident. No. That is, it's all a product of that kind of mentality. And yeah, United certainly saw it, the benefit of closing ranks around him and supporting him. But it is a reaction to the World Cup, but it is also a consequence of that long-standing relationship and a consequence of the benefit of patience, which if people were only a little bit more patient, they would understand.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, you mentioned the treble, and I think, and you know, you mentioned the academy system, the youth system. The uniqueness of that season, the uniqueness of that achievement, I think you're right in that the uniqueness of the ethos and philosophy at the club allowed that extra 1% and those marginal gains for the achievement to happen. And I mean, Beckham himself, I mean, you mentioned it, yeah, he had a terrific season that season. I mean, we forget that, and rightly, Andy Cole's goal against Spurs in the last league game is the one that's replayed most. But Beckham's got a cracking equaliser. The semi-final against Arsenal in the FA Cup, yes, of course, Giggs' is incredible goal, but Beckham's got a cracker too. And then it was Beckham's corners that won the European, you know, that helped win the European Cup. If you put that all together, the uniqueness of that season is based on what I would say, and what you've written in your books many times, that uniqueness of what, in fact, makes Manchester United as a club, doesn't it?
Absolutely, and you've just listed some of the goals and the secondary contributions, the assists. We go back to the semi-final against Juventus. It's another example, isn't it? Everyone talks about Keane's great performance, but Beckham, probably one of his best ever games for United as well. Yeah, and this is the thing, and I think probably something that Beckham doesn't get the credit for, which is ironic, it probably fits the theme with how we're talking about this, is that probably around this time is when people started to become more fascinated with the assists and who created the goals and everything like that. And that's because there wasn't a great deal of credit given to those kind of players. And you've just mentioned all of those, we'll call them secondary contributions, because they're not the headline, they're not the goal-scoring influencers. It's not Sheringham and Solskjaer, but they're both from Beckham corners. It's not Cole scoring the winning goal, but Beckham scores the equaliser. Like you said, one of the best goals that he ever scored against Arsenal gets completely whitewashed from history because of Ryan Giggs's excellent efforts, excellent effort later in the game. So yeah, I think that is one thing that I mean, Beckham did get appreciated for this in this year, didn't he? Because this is why he gets nominated for it. But I think still, yes, he gets it. It's a funny thing because he gets appreciated for it at the time, but then in 20 years when we're having that conversation about it, we're just saying, oh, he was overrated, he's nowhere near as good as Rivaldo or Zidane. Crazy. Whereas you're not looking back and saying, well, actually that year he was so good that he did deserve his place on that platform. He really did. And those contributions, like we're saying, in such crucial games, they were the reasons for why that. I mean, that's why players get nominated for these awards, because they made that
free kick against Barcelona as well. Wow.
What a call. That was one. I mean, he scored a few. That's his. Yeah. A couple against Bromby as well, he scored. It was like he was always doing it in the Champions League. The crosses against Inter Milan.
Wow.
Oh, my God. I mean, what a great performance that was, that first half performance. Mm. And even that one as well. All eyes were on him, how he's going to react to coming up against Simeone again. But he, the professional job he does, I mean, Simeone even goes in on him early on to say, hello, I'm here. Mm. Beckham just gets up, he says, I'm just going to do what I normally do. And we cross two brilliant crosses across at Anfield. Can you remember Dwight York gets on the end, a 2-2 draw, but Beckham's cross, my, one of the best crosses that you've ever seen. Even Trent Alexander-Arnold, it must be the best cross. Mm. It must have been the only cross that he's watched because he's modelled himself on that so often. Incredible.
And that's a legacy in itself, isn't it? If we're talking about such a young talent like Trent Alexander-Arnold, then he's had a terrific season. If the comparisons are that, he's very Beckham-esque, well, that in itself, just that to say he's Beckham-esque in his delivery, wow, what a legacy for David.
Yeah, and the same for, I mean, and this is the other thing as well. I think everyone, I mean, 90% of people would say, well, maybe not 90, maybe 75% of people would say Kevin De Bruyne is the best player in the league.
Mm.
And that is on, 50% of that reputation comes from how good he is from dead balls and delivery.
Mm. Absolutely.
It is, and so... It tells you how much people appreciate those qualities, but they just didn't appreciate them in David Beckham for some reason, because of his haircut, because of the relationship he had with a pop star. It's a funny old thing, really, and because of the fact that he was so well known at that time, because he'd come good, that antagonised a lot of people as well.
Yeah,
you
people
know,
gutted, yeah. weren't they? Oh, he has got everything.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And he's got everything and he's bloody good as well. Yeah. You can imagine, like, scoring that goal. I mean, yeah, scoring free kicks and penalties, you could say there's a certain amount of practice rather than not natural ability, but scoring a goal like he did in open play against Arsenal.
Just against
David Seaman. I mean, you never saw David... yes, a couple of times by freak, he got beaten from range, but never by... true brilliance, rarely by true brilliance, and when it was very notable. And like we said, that Beckham goal in semi-final definitely fitted into that category. Yeah, it's funny because he was one of the victims of the split vote, wasn't he? Roy Keane is the most famous one because they said David Ginola got the got the vote because Roy Keane split the votes. But that the reason why it was split is because Keane was so good, Beckham was so good. And I would say that Keane and Beckham were the two first names that you would say were the best performers. I mean, United had many that season, but definitely Keane and Beckham were the reason why that vote was split. And people say Keane didn't get the award, but it's just as true to say that Beckham didn't get the award because of the split.
I'm sure they'd rather have the medals.
Manchester
United's history as a club and playing style is, I would say, predicated on the need for wingers. I mean, we've had Jesper Olsen, Stevie Coppell, Giggs, Kanchelskis, Morgan, to name but a few. Yet, Beckham and the way he played on the right was unconventional for a winger, wasn't he? I mean, he didn't have the natural ability of Giggs or had the pace of Kanchelskis, but did Beckham, just by virtue of his supreme technique, reinvent what it meant to be a winger?
Yeah, he did. And I talked to Emil Eski for the book, and he said that Steve Guppy would try and copy that technique, you know, stopping, knowing that you didn't need to beat the player before you got a cross in.
Mm.
But that meant you had to be very good at A, finding space, and B, being good with the crossing from a standing position, like David was. You know, you had to be always ready to cross it rather than getting the ball on the momentum of the run once you pass the defender, whipping it in. You know, that's what wingers are taught to do, isn't it? You knock the ball past the fullback and you either take a touch to compose yourself or your first touch is to cross it because you know that the fullback's going to get to you. Beckham didn't always have that. I mean, he wasn't... reference the popular football... management simulations, championship manager or football manager. It wasn't like he had a 3 in pace or anything like that. Maybe not even a 15 in pace, maybe a 14 or 13. He wasn't the slowest, but he didn't depend on that to get past defenders. I mean, I remember some epic tussles that he had with Roberto Carlos, who was as quick as anything.
Yeah.
And he was never embarrassed by anyone who went fast. He was never embarrassed by quick fullbacks, you know, making him look like a slow coach or anything like that. He just wasn't as rapid as Ryan Giggs or, like I said, Andrej Kanchelskis. So he had this extra string to his bow knowing that. And this was the thing about Beckham, is that he understood that he was very mature and responsible for his own technical... Should we call them technical limitations? I think limitations is too harsh. I think his technical capabilities, he was well aware of his strengths and weaknesses.
Mm-hmm.
And it was easily a strength of his to be able to cross the ball before the winger gets to him. Normally, before the fullback gets to him. So the fullback would normally be able to afford to jockey a player because they know that they've just got to try and either block them or stop them getting the space in for the cross. But to do that, they'd normally have to sort of position themselves in a way that where the ball would come around them, whereas Beckham would just stand off them.
Mm-hmm.
So they were in double jeopardy straight away, and that's where Beckham's relationship with Gary Neville was very good, because Neville could create that space as well.
Absolutely.
But Beckham was very good at doing that because he could just drop back a yard and they would know that that player's either got to commit themselves. He was still good at making a player commit themselves and embarrass themselves, but not in the traditional winger style. He had to do that all of his own accord, really, a different kind of winger. It was like a wide midfielder, but he was still a traditional winger. I mean, you look at many of his assists and they are in bombing to the byline and getting the cross in. It's just that he was very good at engineering that space. But one thing that you would say about Beckham is that 99% of his crosses, if he had that space, were always good. Yes, if he was a little bit rushed, it might not be the best cross, but he was so good at doing that. And a big part of that was the ability to find space in front of the fullback. So I say in front of the fullback, where the fullback's offering you space, he was able at doing that. He was able to do that and punish the fullback as well. You know, a fullback might, even against Ryan Giggs, because Giggs didn't cross like that, Giggs would want to get past the defender and cross them, because Beckham could do it in front of them. And that meant that the defender could no longer afford to give him space. They quickly found out they'd get punished, but that was the thing. And that's a thing that he doesn't get the credit for, how good that technique was, because they just say, oh, he just crossed it. Try doing that.
Absolutely.
Try learning how to have the footballing intelligence to be able to stand in front of a player and get that amount of curl and whip over the player into the right area. It's so difficult. I've tried it and I'm not as good as David Beckham. I can certainly say that.
I mean, I would love for someone to be able to do this, and maybe it's a project for someone if they're listening, but in that era and maybe since, that to find, you know, how often David Beckham would knock that ball into what coaches would call the area of danger, around the 6-yard box in that area, how often he would actually get it in there. And how, you know, in terms of percentage-wise, how he would compare to other wingers of his era. I mean, I'd be fascinated to know. And that leads me on to something where, what I always find about your books, Wayne, is the way that you paint a picture for the reader, but also the words, the sentences, the phrases that you use to enhance that mental image. And there's a great one, which it's very relevant to what we've just been talking about, where you sum up Beckham as he became established in the United team and got his England call-up. They had what you describe as automatic quality. And that's exactly what we just talked about, wasn't it? It was an automatic quality. He just got that into that corridor of uncertainty. And it was so difficult to defend against. And does the fullback drop? Does he go with? Do they double up? You had Neville on the other side. You know, you had Cole and York who were able to get in those right positions. You had someone hanging on the edge. It was automatic quality. And I think it is underappreciated. Now, of course, United, much as us fans didn't want to, we had to share David Beckham, the footballer. And nowhere was this more evident than when he pulled on an England shirt. And we've already said how proud he was to play for his country and, of course, to be captain. Now, if there was a game that epitomised Beckham's qualities in an England shirt, it's now infamous match at Old Trafford for England against Greece. Why should this match be used as a barometer for the qualities that made Beckham the player that he should be remembered for?
Yeah, great question. Do you know what's funny is that this is one of those games where people have a different opinion of this on the history, and maybe I don't know what it is, what makes people because I've seen so many people say, "Oh, he had a rubbish game and he wasted all these free kicks." Go back and watch that game.
Absolutely, he was brilliant.
Especially go back and watch the second half. He was everywhere. Yeah. If you want, and this is the thing, and we didn't see it often enough at United, and the reason why we didn't isn't because of David Beckham, it's because of the position in which he played. Now, don't get me wrong, Beckham played from the right in this game. He was a right-sided player, but and that's where he played for United. But there was obvious license for England in this game in particular, where there wasn't for United, where he was able to have a free roll and do what he wanted. He was treated like the Ryan Giggs. You know when Ryan Giggs played in Europe? He could be, yeah, he was on the left-hand side, but he could play wherever he wanted. And you know, Ronaldo to a lesser extent in more recent years, because Ronaldo was Ronaldo and the formation was more fluid. But Giggs was allowed to do whatever he wanted then. And Beckham for England had that kind of role sometimes, especially against Greece, he did have that role. And this was a case, and the reason why he had that role is because he took the responsibility of it. I don't think this is something that came from Sven-Goran Eriksson. I don't think he said, right, David, you go and play a free role because we need you to play a free role. I think he just took the responsibility. And this is what, when you're saying about epitomising what, you know, what it is to be a captain. He took that responsibility, and not every other player. Well, there was no other player who did it, because Beckham was the one who did it. Mm-hmm. He stood up, he took the responsibility, he was taking all the free kicks, he was taking all the set pieces, he was everywhere on the pitch. There's not one passage of play that, if you watch that second half back in particular, there's not one passage of play that doesn't have David Beckham's imprint on it, where he's trying to bring the team forward, he's trying to do something positive with it. And there's a key difference in, and I don't want to disparage Steven Gerrard's captaincy of Liverpool, but when you watch Gerrard influence a game, it's very much the Hollywood, I'm going to score a goal, I'm going to, you know, I'm trying to score from long range. And I don't know if you remember the game against you know, the famous Chelsea game where he slipped?
Yes.
Well, the second half of that game, he's just trying to score.
Correct.
All the time.
Yeah.
And yeah, Beckham did have a few free kicks. But from normal play, he was trying to get every, you know, he's trying to do his normal, you know, he's crossing, he's trying everything. He's covering every blade of grass. He's everywhere on that pitch. He's trying to drive the team on to be better than what it is. He obviously creates the first goal for Ted Sheringham from a free kick. That isn't a shot, it's a cross. Mm-hmm. And then he scores in the injury time free kick, what he gets right at the end.
Yeah.
And he, you know, missed one before that. And that's the other thing with that performance, is the courage to keep doing that, the conviction that, you know, it doesn't matter. This is one thing that I did ask Emi Lesky about, and he said, I said, weren't you getting frustrated with him? And he said, no, because we always believed, like he believed, that the next one would be the one. Imagine feeling like that in the 90th minute when he had a free kick. Mm-hmm. There's still going to be another chance. You weren't frustrated with him because he still felt that he could do something. And there aren't that many players like that anyway. I mean, Gerrard could fall into that category, I suppose. Well, he certainly could. I'm not, you know, going to hide behind that, even as a United fan. He was still someone that you could believe could do something like that. But what I'm saying is, he's rightly revered for that. Beckham isn't revered in the same way, but he had that same quality to be able to do that. And he did it for United many a times. And this was one time he did it for England as well. And that's, I mean, the greatest football moments. Not for you, because I know of your heritage, and you know, it wasn't a particularly great moment for you. But I'm sure that you could appreciate it because it was Beckham.
Yeah.
The fact that he had,
I actually backed the draw that game. I remember, so I was actually grateful for Beckham.
Not so bad then, yeah. But yeah, the quality that Beckham had, what great players have, is that he could take a great moment and make it cinematic. Mm. And that's what he did with that. Even Eske, like I said, he said to me, it felt like I was in a film and I was on the pitch Do you know? Yeah. That's a mark of greatness, isn't it, really? It's the thing that Cantona had. And Gerrard, I'll give him that as well. Mm. Certainly, if you're a Liverpool fan, he had that moment, that quality about him. So, yeah, you know, and Beckham doesn't get that kind of praise. And I hope that, you know, sort of running through it in that way in the book. Well, no, I think that performance speaks for itself. It doesn't need my writing.
Absolutely.
But, yeah, I believe... A lot of people have gone back and over time and revised that performance and said, oh, he was rubbish and he was missing all those free kicks. I urge you just to go back and watch that second 45 minutes. That was how good David Beckham could have been playing in central midfield.
Yes.
And that was from the right-hand side.
Yeah,
he correct. Could have been that. He was so good, so good.
Moving forward then, and as David Beckham's celebrity status increased, I think it'll be remiss not to, you know, just sort of... touch on how this affected his relationship with Sir Alex Ferguson, and within that answer, how good a shot was Ferguson? If we talk about the boot as well,
yeah. When he says something like "I tried a million times," and it would never happen again.
I mean, did that precipitate the end for Beckham? The celebrity status, the boot incident, everything that was going on. Was that the beginning of the end?
It was, but do you know what's funny about it is that there's still a feeling that I had at the time, and certainly when I revisited the book, it was a stronger feeling. Nothing about it seemed terminal. It could have been salvaged.
Yeah.
Everything, it just seemed... I never thought that Beckham's celebrity problem was as big as Ferguson made it out to be. That's me being completely honest. Mm-hmm. I'm seeing that from the outside as a fan, and you're looking back on it as a writer with a slight bias, and, you know, I say Ferguson's the greatest manager that ever lived, and, you know, I've said that many, many times. But I still think that it wasn't as... I don't think it had a destabilising effect on the dressing room. I don't think Beckham was a particularly bad influence. I think Beckham... The problem that they had was that Beckham was so strong-willed, and this was a quality of his that Beckham, that Ferguson loved, which is why he kept him around. And supported him so much after the World Cup, and which is partly why he was so good after the World Cup, because he was so strong-willed. Mm-hmm. Now, you have all these things in the boiling pot, but then Beckham wanting to stay home because his son is poorly.
Mm-hmm.
That's a quality Ferguson would admire. It is.
Absolutely.
I don't care what anyone says. But the reason why that came a problem is because Victoria was seen shopping in London, or she was seen at an event in London. So Ferguson's point or retort to that was, well, she could have been at home looking after the kid and you could have been here. And the trade-off in that situation was that Victoria's career was more important than yours. Whereas Beckham didn't see it like that. He saw it, I'm a father looking after my child, which you would understand. And that's the complication in which Ferguson would say that the celebrity became a bit of a problem. Now, to me, that's only a problem if Beckham reacts badly to the discipline.
Mm.
I don't think it came as a negative effect to the team. Beckham was upset because on that occasion he was dropped against Leeds. It was a pretty embarrassing spectacle for Beckham. He was in the stand at Leeds, and no one could say that he played poorly. So everyone knew why he'd been dropped for that reason. But he didn't react badly.
No.
He didn't throw his toys out of the pram. He didn't say, give me a 500 grand week contract or I'm gone. Everything was just normal for him as a footballer. He just went back to work and tried to play his normal football. The thing where I do think Beckham has some responsibility, because, by the way, all in that episode, I'm supporting Beckham, by the way. I'm saying, you know, he had every right to do what he wanted. And I'm not saying I don't support... I don't see what Ferguson was doing. I don't understand why he was doing it. The things what I think Beckham did, where he didn't help himself, were things like the air cuts, where he knew that, you know, he should have been entitled to have his air cut however he wanted. Fine, I get that. But he knew that it antagonised Ferguson, and he still did it anyway. So he went, it was the start of the season where he'd shaved it. It wasn't the start of the season. It was towards the end of the 99-2000 season, wasn't it, where he shaved his head for the first time. And that was against Leicester, and he'd kept it under his... he had a beanie on. Mm-hmm. And he was obviously too embarrassed to show Ferguson that he had it. Now, if you know that you're embarrassed to show your manager it, you know that the fuss it's going to cause, just don't do it.
Just don't do it in the first place, yeah.
Exactly. But he was 24, 25, still relatively immature as a young man. Mm. Certainly one who's sort of expressing himself and is a bit of a fashion icon. So you would be immature in that kind of decision. But then there was it was the start of the next season, before Chelsea and the Charity Shield, he shaved it into a Mohican. Mm. And Ferguson, he turned up with the beanie again before the game at Wembley, and Ferguson absolutely tore him to bits. He said, there's no way you're having that, just shave it off. Mm. And he did. But at the end of the season, he put it back up. I'm not saying that's an act of defiance at Ferguson. I'm just saying, look at it as it is, and you see that he did it again because he really wanted it. Nobody knew the Mohican story at the time. You know, the first Mohican story, nobody knew about that. But the fact that he did it and then did it again is like, he knew that he wanted the attention for it, and he knew that he was going to get the attention, and he knew that attention for that was going to antagonise the manager. Now, I think that because Ferguson saw it as a power struggle, he saw it as defiance from the player, he didn't appreciate that, you know, the fact that people were talking about David Beckham's haircut could be a good thing because they weren't talking about his team. Yeah. He would have... That kind of thing, I would have presumed Ferguson would have loved. That, you know, that sort of thing, certainly in the sort of second phase, well, the latter phase of his career, you know, I think he would have... The way that I've described it in the book is that if David Beckham had played for anyone else, he would have moved heaven and earth to sign him. Absolutely. Because he would have loved everything that came with him. He would have loved the circus. He would have loved all that, and he would have indulged it. But because it was under him and he'd been developed under him, it was seen as Knights of Defiance. And I think it was... It was that and the sort of standing up to him in the wake of that Arsenal game. The boot is the headline act of that, but he was arguing about the him losing a player for his goal. Now, I don't know if, like I say, I don't think it should have been so bad that it was terminal. Mm. But I think I can understand why Ferguson thought it was at the same time. It's just... It's weird.
It seemed like the point where the boulder was pushed down the hill and it just started gathering momentum, didn't it?
Mm. Exactly. Like one of them had to give. Yeah. You know, Ferguson had already. Perhaps this has got more of a factor than what is given credit. Mm. Ferguson's U-turn on his retirement. So he needed some kind of bold statement to say, I've not lost it. Mm. I'm still in control of the dressing room. For different reasons. You know, like we went back and. Over time, we've talked about it before, George Best and Matt Busby, and Matt Busby saying, I've lost my grip, and part of that was because of Busby not knowing how to deal with this new level of celebrity, whereas Ferguson was basically saying, I don't care about this new level of celebrity, what I say goes. And maybe that was in the short term, it was a negative because the casualty of that was David Beckham, but in the long term, maybe that was a good thing for United. I don't know. I still think that it shouldn't have been terminal, and that Beckham had so much left to give United. I would have loved to have seen him live out his career with United. But then there's another part of me that says, you know, maybe he did want to move away. Do you know? It's difficult to know, really. There was the sort of controversy around the idea that he'd been talking about a move 3 years before he actually
That's
did.
Right. And the protracted contract talks. Whoops. Yeah, and the protracted contract talks as well, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, and all that had added to it. The thing was, Keane had just signed a new contract, which was the 100 grand one, wasn't it? And it was like, so that was now the barometer. So you had Giggs and Scholes and Beckham who were on 50 grand, but they were all or around that. And they were all due a renewal. Mm. But Beckham wanted 100 grand plus image rights and blah, 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 and all that sort of stuff. I don't think that Beckham was... I don't think he was extraordinary in his demands. I don't think he was asking for the earth. And he just... I thought, yes, he was the most famous footballer in the world at that time. So, yeah, that's the... You expect the negotiations to be a little bit more complicated while they or dealing with all that sort of stuff. But it happened, and he signed the deal. Do you know what I mean? I never saw the problem with that as big. And a lot of people did afterwards. They were saying, oh, look at him. He thinks he's bigger than the club, and he wants more. Every time I saw David Beckham play for United, every single time, I never thought he gave any less than 100%.
Agreed. Yeah, agreed. I mean, if you look back on it, and it's always easier to look back rather than, you know, in that moment. I mean, what was the move, the eventual transfer, was it another example of Ferguson's genius? I mean, he did sacrifice reliability and automatic quality in Beckham, you know, for the unpredictability of Cristiano Ronaldo. I mean, he knew the team had to evolve, and he allowed the transfer so that the team could take a different direction. I mean, he was proved right in the end, wasn't he?
He was, and you could certainly say that. And I'm not going to argue with the point. I will offer an alternative theory. Did the transition need to be quite so difficult?
Fair enough.
Could you argue that United win one or two more titles with David Beckham playing in the middle of the park as an alternative option before he moves on?
Correct, yeah.
I think, you know, look, you can't question Ferguson because his decisions were 99% right. And the decision to move David Beckham on, like you said, had a sort of consequential benefit in a certain aspect. So you can't question it. And I certainly wouldn't. I would just say that because I'm such a big fan of David Beckham as a footballer, and, you know, I think he gave so much to the club, that I would have liked to have seen him stay a little bit longer. And, it's just an interesting one, Mike, for me. As far as that's concerned. But I certainly think he could have, like we mentioned it earlier, he could have offered something different in the middle of the park.
I think so. In the chapter that, entitled Spotlight, I mean, you've already spoken, talked about Emil Heskey. I mean, he does feature heavily in this chapter. And you quote him on how the media scrutiny, you know, did weigh heavily on Beckham's shoulders. But Heskey is, you know, from what I could see, is impressed with how Beckham handled the media intrusion. And he also waxes lyrical about the player and the captain, and you've told us that. It's really nice to read, and was it nice to write about too?
Yeah, it was, because, I mean, that was the point I was going for with the entire thing, is that I want to talk about him as a footballer and as a human being, not this sort of celebrity figure that we've got, that we all see, oh, his haircuts and his sarongs and everything like that. The sort of side of him as a captain where... he knows that he's going to have four security members instead of one. Mm. You know, with the one for the rest of them.
Yeah.
And four for him. But he still goes to them and says, and this is when they're in Japan, or I think it's in Japan, in South Korea, where he goes in and he says, come on, guys, should we go out and get something to eat? You know, they're in a foreign land, but he's going to take responsibility for that. Or turning up and he's got all this Gucci gear and he throws it out to the rest of the lads and says, yeah, here you go, help yourself.
That's right.
A generous side to him as a person. And they all, like, say, you know, they'll stop and have a conversation with him now, and he's, you know, he's such a nice guy and he's down to earth and everything like that. It is good to hear those stories, and especially from someone like Emil Heskey. We talked about Michael Owen earlier and the probability that club allegiance plays
in that.
So for Emil Heskey I did ask him, you know, whether he thought it was because he was from Leicester and he'd already been associated with Beckham before he moved to Liverpool, maybe that played a part in it. And he said, you know, he accepted it may have been the case, but you can only take it for what it was. He played for Liverpool for a large number of years and still rates David as highly as any player that he played alongside, and as highly as any captain that he played alongside. So that's alongside Gerrard as well. He did sort of admit the club bias towards Gerrard, but that is what it is, you know, it's club bias, and he acknowledged that. But he couldn't have been more complimentary of David Beckham, and it was good to read, good to hear that as a United fan, really, to hear that he was... You know, yes, we know that everyone at United loves him, but to get that from the sort of rival camp as well was pretty good.
It was good. As we all know, Beckham left United and he went to Real Madrid to be one of the Galacticos. How fair would it be to suggest that his time at Madrid was overall seen as a failure?
I don't think that's fair. I think it was a success, but Yeah, there are mitigating sort of qualifications for that. You know, how much of a success he was. I mean, he won the league, he won a cup.
Eventually.
Yeah, he did. But it was like a reverse trend for Beckham. Like, he came in with this sort of hype of being this player. And I guess you could sort of mirror this with what happened in America as well, that they thought they were getting something. And I think that the problem was the perception of what they thought they were getting, because I don't know, because I only ever know what I saw David Beckham as. So I don't know if they thought they were getting Roy Keane. I don't know if they thought they were getting Ryan Giggs. I always knew what David Beckham was. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't surprised by what I saw from David Beckham in a Real Madrid shirt or an LA Galaxy shirt. Mm-hmm. But maybe they thought they were getting Brazilian Ronaldo or mm-hmm. something like that. Over time, just as he did in the Galaxy, he impressed upon the Real Madrid fans with the things that he did bring to the side. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's ironic because he was brought in and everyone was saying, oh, you've let Claude Makélélé go and you've sacrificed him for David Beckham, and David Beckham doesn't do anywhere near the same kind of thing. No, they were very different kind of players, don't get me wrong, and you could say that Claude Makélélé, that he left and Real Madrid sort of went on a downward spiral because they were missing that kind of defensive screen. But Beckham was very good in the centre and midfield for Real Madrid. It just took him a little while to sort of find his own position, which was more difficult considering the turnover of managers that they had there and the fact that they all had their own interpretation of what David Beckham was. And he played in a number of different positions. In the end, it was his hard work that got him back into the team when he was dropped. He still scored a number of spectacular goals for Real Madrid, and he was well loved, particularly by the Brazilian contingent in the dressing room. Mm. Zidane, who called him, he said something like, "It'll be gold paint on a Mercedes or something like that." Mm. A layer of gold. He basically said, "You know, we don't need David Beckham, and we've got great players here." But even he was won over in the end by how hard David worked for the side. Which was a thing. Imagine being Real Madrid, winning everything as they did, being known as the Galacticos as they were, and being surprised at the level of someone's hard work.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that they weren't hardworking. They must have been hardworking. So to be surprised that David Beckham was so hardworking, that must have been some impression that he left on them.
Absolutely.
And I think that says everything about his entire reign, really, because by the time he left, he was appreciated by the fans for what he was and the qualities that he did have. And you can't ask for more than that. And I don't think that he did ask for more than that, just to be appreciated for what he was. I don't think he would have wanted to be known as the Brazilian Ronaldo, because that wasn't what he was. He was an excellent midfield player with a fantastic range of passing, much better than what people gave credit for, and the Real Madrid fans appreciated it at the end, and as good on dead balls as anyone we've ever seen. And, you know, I certainly think that that was the, you know, maybe Real Madrid fans might say, oh, we've had better free kick takers than David Beckham, but he belongs in the company of the discussion.
Of course he does,
you know?
Absolutely. And then on to LA Galaxy and a new adventure, and I remember at the time the media claiming that Beckham going to the MLS, he was going there as a celebrity, not as a footballer. But Beckham himself didn't see it that way, did he?
No, he didn't. And this is a really big testament to David, because he always saw things in the way that, oh, I'm going to go somewhere for a challenge and prove myself. I don't think he would have left Real Madrid if, you know, he was out of favour when he agreed this deal with LA Galaxy.
Yeah.
And there were teams on the table. But I do believe, and some people might say this is cynical, but I do believe that he didn't want to come back to England and play for a team that wasn't United. So he was looking for the other offers. And yes, perhaps there was something to do with his celebrity profile that made LA Galaxy more appealing than, say, Inter Milan or Bolton Wanderers. Mm. But I think that when the offer was put to him. And it had been something he'd obviously had a soccer school out there, and they'd done the sort of promotional world tours as a couple. I think that LA had held some kind of appeal for him, which is natural. You go to Los Angeles, you can't help but be drawn in by the place and the idea of it. So there was that, and the idea that everyone would say that if David Beckham went, that he knew what they would say, and he knew that they would say that it was because he was a celebrity and that he was going there to retire, and he was going there to prove that that wasn't the case. He was 31 when he made the move, Mike.
Still relatively young.
Yeah, so you know that he's going there for the reason to try and disprove people's minds. He's not going there to retire. He's not going there thinking, I'm just going to call it a day. Because we know that that wasn't the case. He moved in 2007. He's still wanting to come back and play for England. And still wanting to come back and play in Europe at a high level. But he went over there. He saw it as a challenge. He wanted to be someone who did something different. And the thing that he could do different... All right, he'd been to Manchester United and he'd won trophies. He'd been to Real Madrid and he'd won trophies and turned people's opinions around of him. Now, that was as good as it was going to get at Real Madrid. I think that was the peak as what he could expect there. So what he could do next is do something that no player had done before in the modern era, and that is to raise the profile of the American game.
Agreed.
To a standard in which it would be seen as respected rather than a circus. And he knew that he would be seen as the circus. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So talk about the character of someone. To take that on board, knowing how it was going to be perceived, and still having the ambition to say, no, I want this to be seen as a credible way that I was going to play a significant portion of my career. And I think probably now, this is the one thing that he does get a lot of credit for, because we can see that he didn't go over there to retire.
I mean, for me, his time at LA Galaxy is what is less known about him, and also probably the most intriguing, because while at United and Real... we saw the matches, read about him and his football, but in America it was very, very different. I mean, even his own teammates weren't sure, were they? I mean, for example, Landon Donovan was less than complimentary about his arrival. But as you said, he won them over. And, you know, he did raise a profile, and, you know, he did what he set out to do. Now, while at Galaxy, he had two successful loan spells at AC Milan, and then he finished his career at Paris Saint-Germain. Were these carefully orchestrated moves, or were they opportunities Beckham felt he needed to try and get back into, I don't know, the England team?
Well, the Milan one was certainly that, you know, to get into the England team, because he was told in no uncertain terms that if he didn't come back to play in Europe, that he wouldn't be considered. So I think it was the most appealing option that was on the table for him, and, you know, Milan would definitely have appealed to his wife.
Of course.
So that was a great option for him. And Milan had a bit of an old boys act at that time, didn't they? They had Ronaldinho. Obviously, Maldini played until he was 95. and, you know, you had other players, plenty of Seedorf, plenty of experienced stars who were playing for Milan at the time. So it seemed a good environment for him to go into. Still, again, a challenge, because it was a different language for him, a different culture, a different style of football. And, you know, he was successful there. He was very popular as well in a short space of time. They wanted to sign him permanently. But he, you know, he decided to go back to the US when his loan spell ended, because he still had something to prove there. Like I said, the initial doubts that were had of him, from the likes of Donovan and the supporters, they were only strengthened by the first year, because the first year was very difficult. So when he went to Milan, it was seen as Beckham was sort of turning his back on American soccer and undermining everything that he'd gone there to do in the first place. So he still had to go back and prove himself as a top class midfielder and someone who didn't go there just to retire. So he still had all those things to prove, and I think they were more understanding when he went for the second loan spell, because they knew, you know, He was going back to play international football, and that was the only way he was going to get considered. But they also knew that he was going to give everything for Galaxy while he was still there and playing. I think the Paris one probably a little bit more orchestrated, because that had been, he'd known Leonardo at Milan. Paris had made a move to sign him a couple of years earlier. A lot of money was put into Paris, so they wanted a big name like that. So I think that had some more origin in it, like the Galaxy move. You know, there'd been a little bit of planning for that. So the Milan one certainly, I think, was more a nice opportunity that came up. But I still think he gave everything to Galaxy while he was there in terms of wanting to to leave a legacy for what he was as a footballer as well.
I mean, I don't want to, you know, coming up to the end of the book, you know, in terms of going through the chronology of it, and I don't want to delve too much into the last two chapters, which you name Reinventing the Wheel and the Epilogue, as I feel even, I think it's a total of 18 or 19 pages, what you write, I think, should be a personal discovery for every reader and something that they should experience for themselves as they read the book. However, without spoiling it for our listeners and those who have yet to read the book, can you sum up Beckham the footballer? Is it too extravagant to say that he was a cultural phenomenon?
No, I don't think it is too extravagant to say that, because he was, and he was a trailblazer. He was sort of leading that path himself. Nobody knew that level of fame. They still don't. You know, you have to align the stars. You know, you have to have the most famous footballer in the world align with the most famous pop star. You know, it's like someone going out with Kim Kardashian. Mm. You know, and the sort of, well, you can imagine, can't you, Ronaldo going out with Kim Kardashian. That would be something that you would say is sort of comparable. So you have to have this perfect storm. And without that perfect storm, you have to appreciate then how difficult it was for David Beckham, because he was the first person to be doing this kind of thing. So he was learning on the job, as stupid as that sounds. Yeah. But he kind of was, and it still is, in retirement now. And sort of as a club owner, he's still, reinventing the wheel in a certain way. He's still learning to be who he is, because nobody has coped with this kind of attention. And it was something else, absolutely, and he still is something else. Mm. But certainly, I think throughout his career he was something else. This is one thing that I tried to argue against, as you will know, in the conclusion of the book. Mm. The sort of backhanded compliment of, oh, well, David Beckham, he might not be in the top 30 players to have played in the MLS, or the top 30 players to play for United, or whatever. That isn't a backhanded compliment. It's an insult, really. Yeah. You are not recognising how good he was as a footballer. And that was the return to the fundamental point of trying to write the book, is wanting to put that across. He was a brilliant footballer. He was absolutely brilliant. Go back to the Busby Babes. Look at what Jimmy Murphy and Matt Busby wanted. Mm-hmm. The qualities they wanted from a midfielder. Beckham had that in spades. He was absolutely fantastic. And it really was. I mean, in certain aspects, you could say that his fame counted against him at every point of his career, because it made him... It cost him his United career. It cost him being treated seriously enough at Real Madrid. Mm. And it brought the apprehension that went with him to LA Galaxy. Do you know what I mean? These things were all there, negative consequences on his playing career because of his fame. I'm not saying that they weren't... Beckham could have seen that as collateral damage, you know, something that, another challenge, you know, all right, well, it cost me my United career, but I can prove people wrong at Madrid, I can prove them wrong at Galaxy, and he did, you know. Yes, yeah. So you could say it's collateral damage, and, you know, certainly the amount of money that he's got, you'll never, you know, be scrabbling to pay the gas bill again. So,
no,
but... at the same time, you don't begrudge him that. A lot of people do, because they say, oh, he's just famous because he looks good. Look, every single thing that David Beckham has got, he has earned, and he's worked hard for. You can say that he exploited certain things. Yes, he did, but that's what they're there to do. And if you are offered the same opportunities, you're going to take them. And it's not a detriment to that person. You don't detriment them. You don't say, oh, well, because he took that opportunity, I'm going to look at him worse as a footballer. That shouldn't be the case, and David Beckham should be appreciated for what he was. He was one of England's best ever captains. He put in some of the... If you want to look at England's best performances as captains, that Greece performance goes right up alongside anything Brian Robson did, anything Bobby Moore did. It does. It's up there. So that's the kind of esteem that Beckham should be held in. He's one of the best ever players that this country and our club has ever produced.
Agreed. Nearly there, Wayne, and just some general questions about the book, some quick questions. I'm going to ask you the same question I asked you when we spoke about your Cantona book. Can you give me one sentence to describe what David Beckham means to you?
He typifies what a Manchester United midfielder brought through the ranks should be.
Nice. Wayne, which part of the book did you find most rewarding to write about and why?
I did like writing about the early days because I love going back to those kind of times because it's, you know, my own childhood and everything like that. A lot of it was like a journey through my adolescence, a bit like the Eric Cantona one, you know, because I'm like, oh, it's the same period and you relive in some of the great successes. I did really enjoy talking about England on a deeper level with Eske, you know, and the sort of psychological aspects. And yeah, no spoilers on that, but no. I think that when the book comes out, the psychological aspects of playing for England and the press and everything like that, I think that's probably going to get a lot of attention, to be fair. The most enjoyable thing for me, though, aside from all that, because I did enjoy those bits, I did like doing the stuff about the LA Galaxy and talking to all the people there. It was really good. Some of the players really complimentary about him. Alexi Lalas, a very divisive character, but very honest and very open. It was so good to talk and get... Because that's the first time that his career in full is going to be sort of... In the LA Galaxy, is going to be discussed in the same way, well, in this kind of way, you know, put into print in a book. So it's good to talk to them and to have the teammates sort of talking about, you said about Landon Donovan, you know, and his sort of obsession for a while with Beckham's fame and why that was so annoying to him. It was good to talk about that and get it on the record. And now we've got his career as a fault to go back and look back on, you know, and say, well, this is what he actually did rather than this is what he could do if he just did this for another couple of years. We've got a complete account to look back on and say, well, this is what he did and this is the impact that he had and continues to have. And to see how complimentary those people are of him as a person is... perhaps that's it, isn't it? The idea that, you know... We've had so many famous sons at Manchester United. Mm. So many of them. George Best, Bobby Charlton, Ryan Giggs, Duncan Edwards even, Paul Scholes, Gary Neville. Players who pretty much played every game of their career for United. Maybe not Best, but all the others played just about every game. And you wonder, what would it be like if they were given to the world? Well, we know what they would be like. We've seen it with David Beckham. Do you know what I mean?
That's a good point. Yeah.
And the fact that he was raised well, and he did have this high standard of being a good person that he took with him everywhere. The great story, sorry to labour the point, but one story that really stuck with me was the... and it's funny because I've been in LA and I went to this steakhouse and it made me think of this question, this point that was made by one of the players. When Beckham first went there and they had a team bonding... meeting, and this point's in the book, Mike, I'm sure you'll be aware of this one. Donovan had said something like, well, Beckham should get the check because that's the least he should do, and Beckham only paid his share. And Donovan had said before, well, if he doesn't pick up the check, I'm going to have a few words with him. But Beckham only paid his share and Donovan didn't have it out with him.
No.
That to me says everything about Landon Donovan and nothing about David Beckham. Beckham just wanted to be treated the same Absolutely. As everyone else. And I think that says everything that you need to know about David Beckham, that he went there and he's like, no, I'm one of you guys. Can you imagine if he had paid the check for that dinner?
Yeah.
At Billy Morton Big Boots. Steakhouse. Yeah. Billy, Billy Big Boots, who do you think you are coming over here? And this was... And the player's annual salary at that time wasn't even enough to cover their rent to stay in LA. Correct. Two or three of them had to stay in an apartment in LA together just to be able to live there. And yeah, Beckham didn't have that. He could live in a gated mansion in Beverly Hills if he wanted. And I'm sure he did and still does. So he could afford that. But it's the principle of going out and just saying, no, you'll treat me the same as everyone else. And that he expected to be treated the same as everyone else. And that's all that he wanted from that.
That's fair enough.
So, yeah, I think that's... He says a lot about him as a character and, you know... Yeah, I didn't coach him. I didn't know him as a kid. I don't... You know, I've never met David Beckham. But the pride of being a United fan and knowing that's the kind of character that the club develop and knowing that he was like that as a guy right throughout his career is it is good to know. It makes me feel more proud about my own club in a stupid way. It really does.
And I mean, I've told you this story before when I was one of my teaching posts, and so a couple of my students said, sir, can we go to Pizza Hut please? I went, well, no, you've got a lesson, but David Beckham's there. And loads of the kids went out there, and he was there with Victoria, and they were obviously eating, and he spent over an hour just talking to these kids and, you know, signing autographs, because that's the way he was. And any time I ever saw him around Old Trafford, that's exactly where he was, which is great. Finally, Wayne, if you could sit down with David, and I hope Bex is listening, what if there's one question you could ask him, what would it be?
I would like to know, honestly, would he have liked to have stayed at United? And I'm sure the answer is yeah, but I'd love to talk to him about it. Do you know what I mean? Just talk about like what he saw his future being at United, because he'd had such a glittering past, and I'm sure that he did envisage what his future would be at United. We'll never know, because his level of fame makes it impossible for him to be a coach or a manager. And he's got so much to give. I'm sure he'd be a good manager, but I'm sure he'd be an excellent coach. There'd be no one better to talk about the principles of hard work and the quality of hard work and teaching him how to do that. But you'll never see that in the game now, because he's just too famous. Yeah. But it would be good to talk to him about that, because I think his footballing intelligence is so much greater than what people give credit for. And the fact that it is born out of hard work as well. I'm sure there's a few interesting stories about the celebrities that he's met as well.
Excellent, yeah. Okay, so before we go, Wayne, can you tell our listeners who Beckham scored against from the tweet you sent and we mentioned at the top of the show? And I'm sure there are plenty who have waited this long to know.
Yeah. When you first saw me writing about it, what did you think?
I thought it was one of the famous ones, the ones that are known when he was playing for United, you know. One of them ones. I'm fully aware of how, you know, the type of goals he scored, and you know, you talked about automatic quality before. So I didn't really want to say which one in particular. But then, as you know, I texted you and I said, "Bloody, I had to wait this long for it."
Yeah. So it's page 346 in the book, and the sentence is: Beckham was not the type to excite a crowd with an exquisite dribble, but he was of a rare breed, capable of scoring a spectacular long-range goal as he did here. This was typical Beckham, a goal seen so often as to become almost monotonous if it was not so brilliant. And the tweet that I said was basically, you're not going to get this within 50 guesses.
Nah, you're right.
And the point I was making is that he scored that many that we just took it for granted that he was that good. And the goal he scored was against Portland Timbers on the 14th of July, I think 2012, in a 5-3 win. It was the first of two goals he scored. Even the second goal was pretty good. He scored a free kick, but it was the first goal. He touches he sort of sets himself up 30 yards from goal, and then the entire LA Galaxy bench stands up as he takes that touch, because they know something special is going to come, and he bends it into the top corner. Yes, you know what? You could mention 50 goals before that.
Absolutely.
And you could probably say 50 were better than that. But the point is that if that goal doesn't get in Beckham's top 50, it tells you what a special player he was. And that word, special, because people don't say that about him, it should be said. Because you just look back at those goals. Just look back at them. Choose any 50 you want that you think are better than that. Watch them and appreciate how good he was.
Agreed. Absolutely agreed. Wayne, what's next for you? Any new projects you can tell our listeners about?
Mike, that's naughty. So I've got two that you know of, and I can't mention those at the moment. They're under lock and key at the moment. I'm really, really, really excited about those. I'm working on one. Well, I think I can talk about the follow-up to Que Sera Sera.
Yeah.
With I'm actually co-writing it with Paul Parker, and that's
nice.
Going to take up 86 to 94.
Wow.
I think I'm going to 94. We were going to take it up to the first title win in 93, because that's the culmination of the sort of trilogy that I started with Too Good to Go Down and Que Sera Sera, and then this was going to be the nice culmination of it. But then the 94 team's my favourite, so I thought I'm going to indulge in that and move it to that. And do you know what? Now I'm in the middle of writing it, and because Paul's from my favourite team, the indulgence of writing this book is just incredible. I'm really enjoying it. But even now, I'm thinking, oh, it's going up to 94, it's a trilogy, and it's a neat way to end it. But I'm thinking, I'm looking at 99, and it's there in the distance, and I'm thinking, oh, it could be worth doing another one after it. It depends if people want to read it, but certainly this one I'm really enjoying doing, and obviously the other two projects I'm working on as well.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I'm lucky at the moment.
A fourth book is fine. I mean, Rocky IV was fine. Just don't do Rocky V.
yeah, I'll just write it with the fourth book. I'll just do with a great soundtrack. We had a good soundtrack in the late 90s, didn't we?
So we absolutely did. So, Wayne, that's it. Can you tell our listeners when is the book out and where our listeners can interact with you on social media?
The Beckham book is released on September 14th, a little bit later than that in the US, but September 14th in the UK, hardback and Kindle. It's the biggest book I've ever written, by the way. It's nearly 400 pages. It's out with Pitch Publishing, obviously Amazon and Waterstones as well. You can get it there. And on social media, I am Wayne S. Barton on Twitter and Instagram.
Excellent. Thanks again for coming on the show. It's, as always, been an absolute pleasure. And before I go, as always, I want to give the listeners my view on the book. David Beckham has a special place in the modern media-dominated era of football. His critics believe he was style over substance, but this is a view that is either based on naivety, jealousy, or a combination of both. And the book chronicles Beckham's rise as a footballer, but also as a professional in the strongest meaning of the word. He succeeded, faced obstacles, overcame them, and kept succeeding. Whatever barometer of success you attribute to Beckham the player, he ticks that box. And this is explained in excellent detail in the book. As is normal and now expected from a Wayne Barton book, views on the subject are backed up with excellent research and new interviews from teammates give a fresh look on Beckham, the player as well as the person. As I've already said, the final two chapters are important to appreciate a view of Beckham from the, you know, what I would consider the best modern chronicler of Manchester United, given that a large part of Beckham's career was spent at Old Trafford. But Wayne goes beyond that, and the chapters that discuss his time in America are important, as are the interviews with protagonists from across the pond. I love the way Wayne expertly describes the technique that Beckham honed through thousands of hours of practice. As such, the way he does about Beckham, it would be, I would say, poetic to also describe Wayne's latest body of work in the same vein. Barton possesses that same Beckham trait he describes so well, and that this book is another example of automatic quality. And I would say buy it, read it, and enjoy it. This has been Mike Pieri. You've been listening to Shoot the Defence. You can find us on Twitter at Shoot the Defence. And my Twitter is @Del Pieri. And until next time, goodbye.